Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yes, welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City, friends. Yes, here on the show, we don't kiss up to the current guy. Just because the current guy's in front of our face and the previous guys aren't there, even though the current guy does the same thing as the previous guy, but he's sitting right across us. No, we don't do that here. Got a good show for you coming up here today, friends. A lot of fun. As you may know, we were covering extensively South Africa Wine Week, which took place last week. We did a lot of stuff. We did a show last week. And actually, one of the things that we're going to run here in the first hour today is something we taped last week with Jim Clark, U.S. Manager of Wines of South Africa. And what we focus on, friends, this time is we talk about the history of the South African wine industry. It's a really, really fascinating story. We touched on it bits and pieces on previous shows and things like that. And we've talked about it here and there on the show in times past as well, just in general. But it's a really interesting story that relates to the genesis of the industry going back to the 17th century. We talk about the, you know, of course, South Africa, its importance in the world of trade and sailing ships, how that affected the wine industry, all the way up to really apartheid, the effect that apartheid had on the industry, and then things that are now happening with the sort of awakening of the industry in a post-apartheid world. We'll continue that story because I think a lot of what's going on today, contemporarily, is really, really fascinating. We didn't really get too much into that. It's really just a discussion of the history. I'd like to get into in future discussions a little bit more of the cultural components to this and some of the effects that apartheid had on the wine industry and those both white and black South Africans and what they mean to the wine industry, these things, but we didn't quite get that far. But really fascinating conversation. I highly encourage you to check that out. It's a really interesting region with an interesting story. And then in the second hour, I'm pleased to be joined by my two friends, probably the two of the most noted bartenders in all of New Orleans, if not really globally, certainly around the country. Paul Gustings, who is there at Two Jags. Paul's been around 25, 30 years here in New Orleans and a fine bartender, sort of a godfather, if you will, of bartenders. And then Chris Hanna, who also a spectacular bartender, runs the program there at Arno's French 75 Bar. And Chris and his team were recently honored with the James Beard Award for Best Bar Program in America. So we actually recorded this a couple days ago over at the French 75 Bar. Chris was kind enough to host us. Excuse me. And a lot of fun. We just sat there. We were going to talk about fall drinks, but we really didn't get that far. We talked about hospitality. We talked about, this is interesting, there are two different views on the Sazerac, how it's made. We talk about all kinds of different stuff, how they train their staffs. It's really interesting conversation if you're into the world of bars, bartending, hospitality, and kind of maybe even a little bit of a behind-the-scenes look from two people who are noted in the industry and how they go about putting on a program and running a room and all of these things. It's really, really interesting stuff. So that'll be the second hour that we chat with them. Friends, wanted to mention, went to a really good event on Friday evening, last Friday. The Emeril Lagasse Foundation, it's their 13th annual fundraising weekend that went on. They've been doing that for 13 years, but the seventh year of Boudin Bourbon and Beer. That was at Champion Square right there at the Superdome. What a great event, friends, that was. Had a really, really good time. That was the first time I've actually been able to go because of conflicts and other things constantly sort of going on and never been able to attend. This was the first time that I did go. Really great event, really well done. Over 60 chefs, primarily local from the region here, cooking up food. Yeah, you know, and there was a lot of Boudin, but it was not limited to Boudin. Not that I'm complaining because I love Boudin. But anyway, really, really well done. So they sold out to 5,000 people for that event, which sounds like a ton. It's a good sized crowd, but when you have over 60 chefs, open bars, wine, all kinds of stuff everywhere, you don't really wait very long for food. And that's probably my only complaint, not really a complaint, is I wish I could have tried all 60 something things. I got to about five or six of them before I got full. But man, some of the stuff was really, really good. They raised over, so that event is also combined then with the next Saturday, which I didn't get to go to. It's a little too rich for my blood, but the Carnival du Vin event, which takes place, that's about $1,000 a head, seated dinner, raises a lot of money. And between the two events, Boudin Bourbon and Beer and Carnival du Vin last weekend, again, the Arnold Agassi Foundation raised over $3.5 million for children's charities, mostly local stuff, experiential stuff. We talked about that on the show last week when we had Alyssa Braden and Maggie Robert on from Babes and Beignets. And Alyssa's part of the PR company who also puts that on. So we touched on where this money goes. And actually, previously, we also talked to some folks from the Arnold Agassi Foundation. So you know the background there, but very worthy charities, really, really good stuff. The Carnival Devan event, interestingly enough, they had an auction, which they do to raise, this is where they raise a lot of the money. And they shattered the record for the most expensive wine ever purchased at auction. And I was thinking, okay, this is going to be, I think the previous record was like an 1869 Chateau Lafite Rothschild that went for $250,000, something along those lines. This actually, and so I'm expecting something like that. This was a 2015, the Setting Wines, Alexander Valley Cabernet Sauvignon, of course, Alexander Valley there in California, went for a whopping $350,000 for a 2015 Cabernet Sauvignon. I'm thinking, man, you better let that lay down for quite some time, huh? But hey, great. Glad that that made a whole bunch of money and a really excellent event. If you get a chance, make sure you go next year. It goes to a worthy cause. $100 to get in, all the food and drink that you can possibly consume. It's really, really a lot of fun. Great music, lots of good stuff. So happy to be a part of Boudin Bourbon and Beer last week. We'll be putting up some pictures and some stuff on our Instagram pretty soon, a little bit behind in the game on that stuff, but that stuff's coming down the pike. Friends, want to mention a couple events coming up this weekend. Oak Street Po' Boy Festival, yes sir. The Oak Street Po' Boy Festival is coming up on Sunday, and it goes pretty much all day, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Going to have live music, art, handicrafts, and of course, all kinds of different food purveyors selling different po' boys. And it's a classic sandwich. We've talked about that on the show before, a little bit of its origins. It takes place in the Carrollton neighborhood. It's on Oak Street, really, specifically where it takes place, those few blocks right there. And I think it's only like $3 in advance. Yeah, that's right. And $5 the day to get in. And then, of course, you have to purchase food and drink. But it also goes to some worthy charities where the money goes. So there's going to be 50 vendors taking part in this. Boucherie, Giacomo's, Pascal's, Manali, all kinds of folks are going to be out there. GW Finns as well, great music. So check that out this Sunday. It's not both days, just Sunday on Oak Street. The Po' Boy Festival. That's a lot of fun. And then also the second annual Harvest the Music Festival, which is a benefit for the Tipitinas Foundation, also a great charitable cause there. And the Second Harvest Food Bank, a terrific cause there. That takes place at Tipitinas. That is Saturday evening, 9 o'clock. Showtime's at 10. Price is only $10 to get in. There's VIP tickets for $75 that I think get you balcony access and some things like that. That's going to feature the fantastic Dumpster Funk music there, the headliner. And then also a rising band, great funk band. If you haven't heard them, they're called Sexual Thunder. Great name for a funk band, by the way. They're going to be awesome too. So that's the first band, and then Dumpster Funk is the headliner. That's at Tipitinas this Saturday, November 11th. Doors at 9, show at 10, $10 to get in. Second annual Harvest the Music Festival featuring Dumpster Funk and Sexual Thunder. Friends, a little bit of a show note for next week, because we're going to run this show. As I mentioned, we got Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa talking the history of South African wine coming up right after this next break, and that'll take us to the top of the hour. And then in the second hour of the show, as I said, we're going to chat with Chris Hanna of French 75 Bar and Paul Gustings of Two Jags, and that's going to take us right through to the end of the show. So I wanted to mention next week's show. We've already got that lined up, which is a rarity for us here on the show. Usually we're not that organized to have things all planned out for next week, but it's already, I don't want to say it's in the can because we haven't done it yet, but who we're going to have on already all set up. We're going to chat with Fred Parent, who is he's one of the ambassadors, U.S. ambassadors for Hendrix Gin. And we're going to talk with Fred a little bit about Hendrix Gin and maybe some fall gin cocktails, some things like that. That'll be an interesting conversation, a bit about his background, a bit about Hendrix Gin. Should be interesting stuff there. And then we're also going to be talking with Braith Tidwell and Patrick Brennan over there at Brennan's Restaurant, of course, right there on Royal Street, right by the courthouse. Famous, one of the grand dames, as we say here in New Orleans. And we're gonna go into their new wine cellar, their wine room. And we're just going to talk a little bit about Brennan's. We're going to talk about their wine program, their beverage program, the restaurant in general. But it's a beautiful space that they have down there. I went to a tasting, actually, as part of the South African Wine Week last week there. What a great room. So we're gonna go in there. We're going to talk with Braith. We're going to talk with Patrick a little bit about their program, as I said, and the setting. And it's, you know, it's one of the important restaurants, of course, in New Orleans and in the French Quarter. And it's the first time that we've, here on the Noel Drink Show, paid a visit to Brennan's in this capacity. So it's going to be a lot of fun to tape with those guys. So that'll be great. So again, next week, Fred Perron from Hendrix Gin and the gang from Brennan's. All right, friends, we're going to take a little break here on the show. We come back, as I mentioned, Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa, and then we're going to carry right on with Chris Hanna, French 75 Bar, and Paul Gustings of Two Jags. Great show, friends. Right after the break, stay tuned, don't go anywhere, and come on back. I may be high,
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's Bar Bar's sips and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour, every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning in today. And yes, we are recording this here at Bacchanal Fine Wine and Spirits in the Bywater. And as you know, last week was, right now it's actually South Africa Wine Week while we're recording this, but when you're hearing this, it was last week was South Africa Wine Week. And we are chatting here with Jim Clark, who is the U.S. Manager for Wines of South Africa, otherwise known as WOSA. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Absolutely. And we talked about this not too long ago, but once again, congratulations. You just got back from your honeymoon in Japan.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely. And it sounds like you had a great trip.
It was fantastic. Yeah.
Great. Great. And now hit the ground running again down here in New Orleans and doing South Africa Wine Week, which kicked off, in this case, as you folks are listening to this, last Monday. And here we are on the Wednesday at Bacchanal. How are things going so far?
Really good.
How are they gone?
Really good. We got a lot of great accounts doing wines by the glass all week. So I've been stopping in and saying hi to a few of those. And really, the events are really getting started today with our tasting here at Bacchanal. And then we have something at Brennan's later this afternoon, and then I'll be out at Rosedale kicking off their kind of special dinner menu going with South African wines.
Yeah, and that'll be great. And so we'll have a chance to, this will sound all really weird, it's a time warp thing because we're going to do the show live in the studio, what is tomorrow for us, what was last Thursday for you. So we'll circle back and report on all those events. I'll let everyone else do the math on how that works. But what we were going to talk about here today, Jim, before we kick things off with the tasting at Bacchanal, is it's something we've touched on a little bit, but I want to go a little bit more in depth. It's a fascinating wine history in South Africa. And I think one of the things that we're talking about here in the week as to why New Orleans for South Africa Wine Week is not necessarily that there are direct relationships culturally between the two cities, little bits probably, but there's a lot of interesting historical and cultural parallels to South Africa and New Orleans, sort of a kindred spirits maybe in many ways. But can you tell us a little bit about how, let's go all the way back to the 16th century and when the wine industry kicked off in South Africa.
Yeah, well, we do actually have the birthday for the industry, because the Dutch had stopped in what is now Cape Town a couple times. Basically, they were going around the southern tip of Africa to go to the Far East for the maritime spice route. And they said, we're going to set up a colony here as a replenishment station for our sailors. And they started that in 1652. By 1655, we know that they brought some cuttings and planted vines. And the whole purpose was to make wine for the sailors. And they wanted to do wine because wine is actually healthier. You know, we always talk about the British are called limeys because they would have limes to prevent scurvy.
Yep.
Well, wine has some vitamin C in it as well, so that also can be healthy and is better than drinking rum. So they figured, they looked at the Iberian sailors who did that and said, well, let's follow that model, even though the Dutch themselves don't have a great wine tradition in Holland.
Right. So I misspoke. So it was the 17th century when things kicked off. Okay,
yep,
got it.
Yep. So that's 1655, they planted grapes. And then Jan van Riebeck, who was the commander of the Cape at that time, in 1659, on Groundhog Day, actually, February 2nd, wrote in his diary, "Today, praise be to God, wine was made for the first time from Cape grapes."
Wow.
Yeah.
Do we have any idea what varietals were maybe brought or what was planted there initially?
We believe that it was the three white varieties were the first varieties brought, which was Muscat, Chenin Blanc, and Semillon.
Okay.
So
all out of France then, basically, or Muscat from Italy, perhaps?
I mean, Muscat was kind of all over a lot of kind of the Mediterranean area, so it was one of those stops. The Dutch had a lot of connections kind of going down the coast of France, so I think that's where the Semillon and the Chenin come in
from,
the river openings of the Loire and what have you.
And then Bordeaux.
Yeah.
Okay, perhaps.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. So this was basically as just a way to, as a replenishment station.
Yeah.
And then where did it go from? Did it maintain that status for quite a while then, or did it start to, when did it start to burgeon into an industry in and of itself beyond just stocking ships?
Well, within a century, so by the mid-1700s, there are some records of exports. And but by the end of the 1700s, you were actually finding people talking about South African wines in a very complimentary fashion. And actually, there's this one. Today it's a wine region. At the time, it was just one farm called Constantia. And the successor to Jan van Riebeck, his name is Simon van der Stel, and he planted about 100,000 vines in this area in the late 1600s. But it was the late 1700s where it really took off. And this was a sweet wine, a late harvest sweet wine made from Muscat.
Oh, okay.
And it was the talk of Europe. I mean, Jane Austen mentions it in her novels. Baudelaire mentions it. Napoleon mentions, I think, three wines in his memoirs. Chambertin, so Grand Cru Burgundy, Champagne, and Constantia.
Really?
So it was in very good company. And when he was in exile in Santa Elena, the records show, from 1815 to 21, he actually had a standing order of six large casks of Constantia each year.
Really?
Yeah, so he was definitely into it, and he was not the only one.
Very interesting. Now, so we're talking about these wines being exported back up to the old world, if you will. Mm-hmm. Were wines headed in the other direction, too, when the Dutch sailors were going around, or anyone else? Were they taking it to the subcontinent, for example, and over into Southeast Asia?
I don't know. I don't think there was a huge market there, and this would have been, it might have been something more when the English took over, because they were a bit more serious about replenishing their colonies, say in India and things like that. I could see that as a possibility.
That would make some sense. Yeah. So at what point then maybe we move from there. So at what point did that happen, and what did that change things with the industry?
So the English, this we're kind of working backwards. So the English would have started early 1800s.
Okay.
So when they took over and then basically maintained control. Well, then it became not the actual Dutch, but then the Dutch descent, the Afrikaners. And there was a lot of tension between the English and the Afrikaners all the way up, some would say all the way up till today.
Right.
But, I mean, really the big conflict was then the Anglo-Boer War. Boer, B-O-E-R, means farmer in Afrikaans. So this was the war between the English and the African, the Afrikaner settlers, the Dutch original settlers, which would have been the turn of the 20th century.
Okay, right.
So by that point, the wine industry actually was already having some issues, because phylloxera hit South Africa very hard, starting in, I think, around 1880, 1885.
So interesting. So not too long after Europe then.
No, it caught on very quickly down there. Unfortunately, I think it hit rather hard because the industry was quite compact at that time, so the vineyards were quite close together, so it was very easy for it to spread. And also, when solutions were being found in France, their priority was not to tell the South Africans. Maybe word on how to address the problem didn't reach South Africa as quickly. So that was the beginning of hard times. Then World War I actually was quite rough for South Africa in terms of economics. It created a depression in the economy. And in 1918, in response to that, the industry created a company called KWV. Today, KWV is a private wine company. It's not really related to KWV at that time, because at that time it was a big cooperative. And basically, its function was to guarantee that farmers would have a place to sell their grapes.
It was sort of a co-op.
It was a co-op. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So the whole thing was the farmers could just not worry about they had a guaranteed market for the grapes, and the co-op would either make wine of it, or if they had too much, they would distill it, and they would just kind of take care of all the marketing of it. at that point.
Was this the kind of thing, too, where it sort of reminds me maybe of Cuba, where farmers drop off their grapes at the co-op, and then they don't even really know where it ever ends up going?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, it would be that sort of thing. And then by 1924, the government devolved a lot of regulatory power onto the co-op. So the co-op could say, you know, how where you could plant, what grapes you could plant, things like that. It's kind of set quotas and what have you.
Okay.
And that was fine as far as it went. But over the course of the 20th century, it really led to a commoditization of the grapes, because they weren't doing much in ways of distinguishing grape quality versus quantity. So the farmers are being paid by the ton. So what do? You make more tonnage. And as we know, oftentimes higher yields means lower quality.
Right. Let's do this, Jim. We're going to take a little break here, and then we're going to come back. We're going to pick up the story with the history. We're now in the 20th century, and there's some other very dramatic things that some of us might be able to imagine with South Africa and the history, how it's affected the wine industry. Friends, we are here at Bacchanal Fine Wine and Spirits, a great place here in the Bywater. Live music being performed as we speak on a Wednesday afternoon by Raphael Boss. Come check this place out. It's really a special place here in New Orleans. We'll be right back. Come on back.
From the historic Upper Pontalba building on Jackson Square to the ever-evolving farmers market, our six-block district celebrates New Orleans food, music, and culture through events, festivals, walking tours, health and fitness classes, and also children's workshops at the New Orleans Jazz Park. Visit our calendar of events at www.frenchmarket.org. The French Market, making history fun since 1791.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
When a cold chill begins to burn,
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and podcast land, wherever you may be. Chatting with Jim Clark here, who is the U.S. manager for Wines of South Africa, putting on South Africa Wine Week, which occurred, as you're hearing this, last week. And Jim is telling us a fascinating history of the wine industry in South Africa. And now, Jim, we've moved into the 20th century. We talked about World War One a little bit. More dark clouds on the horizon is maybe a way to put it.
Yeah, yeah. The 20th century was not good to South African wine. It's quite complicated because, on the other hand, we said it kind of led to this very commodification of the industry, where basically, imagine a world where basically the whole industry is making $10 wine or whatever the equivalent would have been in its time. There were still some estates privately making more premium wines, but not too much. But with that, you had great developments. Like in the 1950s, South Africa really is responsible for developing cool temperature fermentation. So when you can combine World War II, where they developed the filtration, where you could actually make a wine with a little bit of sweetness and it wouldn't re-ferment in the bottle. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a European development, I think a German one, if I'm correct. But the cool temperature fermentation, that combination leads to a style of wine that had never existed before. And it's a style that's kind of derided now. But if you think of that kind of light, off-dry white wine, like in California examples would be like the Jug Chablis, quote-unquote, that Gallo made in the 70s. Right. Well, that style started in South Africa, and that was a revolution at the time, because before that, white wines really, you couldn't do that. It had to be dead dry, and even then, it probably wouldn't travel very well. Mm-hmm. It was red wines.
A lot of oxidation and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. So, and within that style, in the mid-1960s, there was a brand called Lieberstein, which sounds German, but it was actually a South African brand, and it was the largest packaged, branded wine in the world, and it was South African.
Really?
So,
and this is when, Jim? I'm sorry?
Mid-1960s.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, fascinating.
Now, obviously, concurrent with that, I'm talking about dark clouds, starting in 1948 is really when we kind of count as the real beginning of apartheid. Before that, we have a period that I think we as Americans can relate to, because we would have called it segregation. Apartheid was distinct as a separate set of policies that went beyond that. And by the 70s, this is why you kind of see that peak of this brand in the 60s. And the 70s is when the rest of the world starts looking at South Africa and actually seeing what's happening with apartheid.
Pushing back economically.
Yeah. And that really takes off as things become, protests become more violent and the rest of the world becomes more aware of that through the 70s and 80s.
Jim, prior to that, when we're talking about export stuff in the 60s and then coming up into that time, was it a global export market at this point, or is it a lot of stuff coming to the U.S., a lot of stuff going to Europe? Or?
A lot was still focused on traditional markets, which would have meant the U.K. and the Netherlands, so you think of those cultural connections that go way back. But some in Germany. I believe there was some coming to the U.S., not terribly much.
Okay, no. Got it. So then now 70s, 80s, we're pretty much in a trade embargo kind of world, right?
Yeah. So now it's interesting. That can be exaggerated. I mean, technically, the U.S. government only had an embargo against South African products from 1986 to 1991.
Okay.
So it was just 5 years. But obviously, there were private embargoes. You know, if you remember, there was the whole university divestment in South African and, products and all that sort of thing. So definitely the attitude, the receptivity, even if they could export, didn't mean that people were receptive.
Right. Okay.
And then other countries had different embargo periods as well. But it did really start cutting the industry off from what was happening in the rest of the world. However, a lot of forward-thinking producers were starting to see that the end of apartheid was going to come. They were going to rejoin the international market, and there was a renewed interest in quality. It started with some classic producers like Simon Sig and Baxberg that are in the Paarl and Stellenbosch areas. But one thing that really kind of lit a fire for people was an outsider, actually, and that was Hamilton Russell. And what he did is he planted in an area called Hemel in Arda, which now is regarded kind of as South Africa's Burgundy. It's great for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And as I said, imagine it's a world where everyone's making $10 wine.
Yes.
He went and planted an area where you weren't supposed to plant. He had to find a legal loophole to get out of those quota systems, remember, that KDV was regulating. Yes. planted out there and then made wines and sold them at a premium. Imagine if everyone's doing $10 wine. He said, I'm going to sell this for $40. People said, oh, that's crazy. Who would pay that for a wine? Wines cost $10.
And this was mostly to the South African market?
This is domestically, yeah.
Yes, okay.
And however, then the wine sold out. And that was a real, not an alarm bell, but a wake-up call for the industry that, like, no, people will pay for quality. And between that and the fact that you could start to see that apartheid was going to end, there was going to be an export market, it really motivated a lot of producers to start upping their game.
Okay. And that's really interesting. And we've kind of talked about this in times past, Jim, from a different angle, where the wine industry of South Africa during the times of apartheid was sort of an entity unto itself, meaning they had to be everything to everyone within South Africa. So you're producing wines in South Africa to appeal to as many people within South Africa as you can, and maybe that led to some less than ideal planting choices and certain things like that, where you're trying to replicate the broader wine world in this smaller stage.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, there's a term the wine industry likes to use called cellar palate. And this is usually talked about within an individual winery, where a winemaker doesn't taste their own wine a lot, but doesn't taste other people's wines and doesn't have his wines or her wines in context. And I think that's kind of what happened to the industry, is that there were, like, especially with Pinotage, which we can talk about in more detail if we want, but there were some earthy and kind of off aromas that a lot of South African winemakers took as a given or just kind of overlooked because they were so used to them that they didn't see them as a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the export markets opened starting in the early 1990s, they started exporting these wines, and some of the wines came in for a negative reception, and the winemakers were surprised because they were used to these aromas.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
And didn't realize that they were a problem.
That makes a lot of sense. So now we move forward. Some of these economic pushback, we'll call it that, not really a trade embargo, as you said. So the world starts to open up for South Africa.
Yeah, well, 1990, Nelson Mandela was released. And then 1994, you had the first free elections in South Africa. And it was during that period that most of the embargoes started falling. And if you think of Cape Classics, which was the real leader for importing South African wines to the U.S., they got started in 1992. So you can kind of see things starting to change there. This is kind of not the official history, but the way after that, I see it breaking down into three periods. From the early 90s to 2000, there's that first initial push, and a lot of people in the U.S. were very interested in South African wines, and they thought this was, they knew the history, people in the industry wanted to take part. And then the wines were a real mixed bag, and I think some importers and distributors felt they got kind of burnt by some of these wines that weren't as good or weren't in the style that they expected or wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And around 2000, you see with a change in winemaking, the South African wine producers being able to travel abroad and see what's happening, started changing their wines and improving things quite a bit. But there's still this crisis of confidence now. So when you taste a Shiraz from that period, you would have tasted a wine that tasted like it was trying to imitate an Australian Shiraz. Or if they were making a Chardonnay, the Chardonnay looked like it was trying to imitate a California oaky Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
So you lose that sense of place. These wines are very international and don't really speak of South Africa, even if they are good.
And it's a mimicry phase, which I think we've said before, and you're sort of forcing the issue to try and create something that doesn't necessarily fit with an identity, doesn't fit with the terroir, perhaps.
Right.
Even.
Right. And then I think the third phase post-apartheid for the wine industry has been starting around 2007, 2008, where he said, okay, now we know how to make quality. Let's trust our vineyards and let's make the wines that they want to make.
And then should make and can make and do and all that.
And that's why things have really taken off in the past 10 years.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's do this, Jim, because we got a few more minutes here before the tasting's going to kick off. So let's take another quick little break and then come back and we'll bring it up forward to today.
Sounds
great. Work for you? Okay, fantastic. Friends, we're chatting with Jim Clark here, who is the U.S. Manager for Wines of South Africa, and we are here at Bacchanal Fine Wine and Spirits. We're going to come back, and we're going to bring up the history of, or bring us up to today with the history of South African wine. Come on back.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petite Sirah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, of course, as always, on the NOLA Drink Show, chatting with Jim Clark here from Wines of South Africa. So, Jim, we left things off in the initial steps in a post-apartheid world for the South African wine industry, and you mentioned those three phases. So we've moved into this third phase where people are doing what they should do. There's a found identity there, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of the attention on this has been focused on kind of the young, hip boutique winemakers. It really started with this region called Swartland, which has had grapes for a really long time, but a lot of them were being used for brandy and fortified wine production. And when those styles kind of fell out of popularity in South Africa in the 1950s, they were just kind of selling grapes to the co-op. So there's these wonderful old vine vineyards sitting around up there not being utilized to their best potential. So it really started, if you're familiar with a brand called Goats de Rome.
Okay,
it's made by a gentleman named Charles Back, and he was up in this region, Swartland, tasting some of the co-op's local wines. Said, actually, these are really good. And he decided to create a separate brand called Spice Root just to take advantage, to focus on Swartland grapes. And he hired a young winemaker called Eben Sadi, and their first vintage was 1997. And the wines were very good. They got some attention. Then in 2000, Eben went on his own, went a bit more boutique, made his own wines, and people really sat up and took notice. And then for a while, he was kind of the lone voice out there. There were a few other wineries trying to do something. But really, 2007, 2008, you see Audie Bonhurst, the Molyneux, and a few other people really diving in with the Swartland. And the motivation for them was well, partially the vineyards were fascinating. You had 80-year-old vines and things like that. But also, if you're a young winemaker in South Africa at the time and you want to get started, Stellenbosch, there's no land available to buy that you would actually want to plant on.
Okay.
And the grapes are more expensive, so you start looking around and you find this region with Swartland where these old vines are not being taken advantage of. So that was really kind of the motivation for them. Now, since then, we've seen similar kind of young boutique winemakers doing that across the Cape, finding other little regions. There's actually an area now north of Swartland called Citrusdal, and people are finding some really great old vine vineyards up there, and you know, dry farmed bush vines, all the things that kind of keep yields low and keep the vineyard focused on quality. But what's important is not just that these young boutique, because boutique wineries are great and people love to write about them, it's a great story, but the guys who went to school with these winemakers, some of them, you know, they're coming from their family winery and they're going back to the family winery, but they've got that same attitude, that same eye for quality.
Okay.
So you look at, Murray Barlow is the winemaker at Rustenburg. Classic property, goes back to 1682. I think Murray is the fourth or fifth generation. Well, they've been making very good wine for a very long time, and now he's even upping the standard because he's seeing what those guys are doing and he's friends with them. He's gone to school with them. He's got that same mentality, but he's got a whole great estate to work with. So he can do wonderful things working with his estate fruit and he doesn't have to search for vineyards.
Right. Now, a couple questions actually, Jim, that spring to mind. So
are within the bounds of I'm sure, assuming general agricultural permitting that needs to go on in any place, are people essentially free to plant what they want, where they want, and develop new regions? And
at this point, yes. As I mentioned, KWV had a lot of regulatory power back in the day. That ended in 1992.
Okay.
So, and that's why you see a lot of exploration. If you go down the coast from Stellenbosch, there's all these kind of maritime cool climate areas that heading down to Hemel and Arda, where I mentioned earlier, that weren't being explored as deeply before because they weren't allowed to be. Mm-hmm. And now we're becoming a source of some really exciting wines.
My second question then, and it sounds like one of the things that I find with successful wine regions, especially newer wine regions, they seem to do better for themselves when everybody plays like a good little kid in the sandbox together. And are we seeing that for the most part? I'm sure there are exceptions, but are we seeing that for the most part in South Africa?
Very much so. And I think that's one of the great things about these younger winemakers. There is a real sense of community among them. There's actually a group called the Zoo Biscuits, which it's kind of like calling yourself Animal Crackers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little cookie that they have in South Africa. And they're all kind of the same generation, and they only became a group because we have an annual convention down there, a triennial convention, called Cape Wine. And they wanted to get a booth at Cape Wine, but being so small individually, they felt they couldn't afford to do it by themselves. So they formed a group just for Cape Wine. And their wines and their personalities and everything was such a hit that they've actually informally become a group that markets themselves together, even though each winemaker is doing their own different thing.
I've seen some cute little graphics. It's like a little school bus or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. A little school bus with each of them. Yeah. So
that's cool. And I think that's great to hear because that bodes well for the future of the industry. Let's talk about that then. So one of the things that I think that we should mention, and we've gotten into this before, but we're now producing world class wines that have a South African identity, and then we're now starting to see these wines. Correct, Jim. The markets are expanding. People are taking notice.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've seen. Well, just this year, I've kind of felt like we've had our troops massed on the border for a while in the terms of the press and, some leading sommeliers and things have really been excited and talked a lot about South African wines, but we haven't seen the number move, or we hadn't seen the number move on actual exports. But this year, according to some industry reports, we're up 13%. And the only other countries that are up double digits were France, which is largely based on the popularity of rosé. It's almost all Provence rosé that's been moving up. And then Portugal has been up quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But even some of our other New World competitors, who had been doing very well, are not making the big strides that they were. So to see us suddenly jump ahead like that is really gratifying, and I think shows that people are really catching on, not just at the trade level, but the average American wine drinker is open and interested in what's happening in South Africa.
I think so, and I think in the impetus for South Africa Wine Week, here's my verb conjugation, that has gone on here, I think is a good example, is exemplar of that, in that taking that step, Jim, where people who are in New Orleans here in the industry are behind the wines, and now it's been time to take that step forward and share that with a consumer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for our organization, it's something we'd like to do more of, but our organization is me for the U.S.
Right.
So you can understand why it's hard for me without the industry getting behind us and hosting these events, whether I'm there or not, or I can't be everywhere in the U.S. market, so it's very hard for me to reach out to the consumer very often.
But, so you're building ambassadorships in different places.
Exactly, yeah.
And with New Orleans, then, it seems we will have talked about this on the last week's show, but talking about the flavor profile and how it works in New Orleans. But this is a great market for it, is it not? Because it's a place that people are exploring new wines, I think kind of breaking out of the California or France only mold, maybe a little bit of Italy. It's a fertile ground, I think, here.
I think so, and I think for a few reasons. One, I think because there's been a real French and California concentration here, a lot of the major varieties in South Africa are your international varieties, we would say, but French, the Bordeaux varieties, Syrah, Chenin Blanc. So varieties that people are already familiar with, and now they can take the step and have a South African rendition of it, be it a Cabernet-based blend or a varietal Chardonnay, things like that. The other is Chenin Blanc is the most planted variety in South Africa, and we've talked about this before. I think it's a great match with the local cuisine.
Absolutely.
So I think that's been a real point of receptivity here. So that's one of the reasons we decided we wanted to do this here. We haven't done this in other cities. This is a New Orleans thing for us.
This is the first one, and I think it fits really, really well. And we're talking about Shannon being such a good pairing, not going too far down that road because it's a topic for a different show. But even some of the red wines that I've been tasting lately coming out of South Africa, now that we've moved past that mimicry phase, they're lighter in body. They're lower in alcohol. They're less oak. And some very, this one that we tasted recently, Sanso base. Mm-hmm. And just, really nice wines that also go, I think, year-round with much of the food here as well.
Yeah, I think the move toward these fresher wines, instead of trying to make big, ball-busting wines, it's make these wines that are food-friendly, that you can just drink and enjoy and don't have to. You can find wonderful, complex, powerful wines if you want, but you can also find wines that are great for every day, and they're not trying so hard to be. They're being special instead of trying really hard to be special.
And then be something that they're not. That makes a lot
of
sense. Well, Jim, you've got a tasting to do, so we're going to do that. And we're having fun here at Bacchanal. I appreciate you taking some time out to talk with us. And we're going to do it again.
Sounds great.
Excellent. Friends, come on back to the show. We got more for you. Come on back.
Shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petite Sirah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
With the season's beautiful weather, it's a perfect time to take a drive across Lake Pontchartrain and visit New Orleans' only local vineyard and winery, Pontchartrain Vineyards. Our tasting room is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon till 4, or by appointment. Come enjoy a flight of our wines in our classically styled French Provençal tasting room, or pack a picnic lunch and enjoy a bottle of wine on our patio overlooking the vineyard. While you're there, ask about our wine club. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to over-oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc. A great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers. Night before last, I got loaded on a bottle of whiskey. On a bottle of whiskey. Night before last, I got loaded on a bottle of whiskey. On a bottle of whiskey. Though I feel all right. Feel all right. I feel all right.
Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Hour number two of the show. Thanks for tuning in. And if you are listening at the top of the show, you know we're here at French 75 on Bienville Street in the quarter, part of the Arno's restaurant, the famed French 75 bar. And pleased to be joined by my friend Chris Hanna, and who's hosting us today. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Absolutely, man. First time on the show.
Oh, yeah. It's my first time on the show, but I guess putting it off for a couple months. I've been on some random trips, but we're finally here.
So. Yeah, you've been a busy man. So, yeah, making it work.
It's been a good year.
Yeah, right on, man. We'll get into that. And Paul Gustings, my friend also. Paul, welcome to French 75. Is it my place to say that?
It's the first time I'm in here. I have never been in this place. It's like, wow, this is great.
Well, Paul, Chris, Paul.
Well, it's nice to meet you. Yeah, Thank you very much. You know? Yeah. Thank you much for being here.
Well, yeah, looking forward to it.
It is a great bar.
It's a great, absolutely great bar.
Absolutely.
And recent recognition there for you. Speaking of that, Chris, I'll say this, you know, James Beard Award winner. Congratulations, man.
Hey, it was about time.
It was about time, right?
Absolutely. I've been saying this for like two or 3 years. It's like, you know, the flavor of the year goes away, and then we have Chris left.
Right.
And then the flavor of the year is usually not that good, but this is very, very well deserved. And it was about time.
Thank you, guys. It was amazing.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, Chris. Tell us about your experience when you were found out you got the award, and then you got to go to New York, right? And was it Chicago?
Yeah, actually, Chicago.
Yeah.
Chicago has it for 7 years, and going the last 3 years, it's really amazing just to be in that room with just everybody like filled with people who are just as passionate about whether they're, you know, cooks, bakery. I mean, you know, whichever kind of like culinary award that's being given out. And for 5 years now, the bars have been finally included, and so it was really truly amazing to
as its own category, right? Yeah. There's a bar category.
It's only been 5 years.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought it was been longer than that.
Yeah, I think I'm either the fifth or the sixth. I think I'm the fifth.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
That's
not long. I know it's not longer than six. So I think it's just six.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's amazing company, you know, and then like. Just being up there, seeing your bar mentioned with those other bars, like on the screen, and it was just truly, truly fantastic. I mean, obviously, I was like extremely nervous to walk all the way up there and turn around and see everybody in the whole, you know, the Opera House looking back at you. That was extremely interesting. I didn't know how I was going to pull that off, but I guess I made it.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. And you got to go out drinking with Chris Morales. That's good.
Yeah, that was he found me. I didn't know how he found me. Yeah,
I know.
I left everybody and thought I was going to be all alone going to Lost Lake, and then all of a sudden Ubi was there, and then man, I don't even remember the next two bars.
Hey, you probably should.
Yeah, I got a call at like 4 o'clock in the morning. No, I did.
I saw the picture and I was like, man, I don't remember that at all.
No, that was good. It was very. It's a well deserved thing. Way overdue, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, one of the things I noticed, Chris, too, that was really nice. Some of the comments I saw on social media were from people that used to work with you here, that you recognize as being a part of the process, but then also had high praise for you, which I think speaks highly of you and the program.
It was amazing. Yeah, the amount of people like Facebook. My phone broke, to be honest. I couldn't even use it for a day. It was truly insane. Yeah, cool. the amount of love and everybody being happy for the bar and me and the team was pretty special.
That's great. And again, congratulations.
Right on.
Well, Paul, well so deserved. Tell us a little bit. So now you're at Two Jacks again.
Yes, I am.
And how's that going over there, man? That's
really good.
Great spot.
I'm very happy to be back. I was gone for like 3 years, 3.5 years, and now I'm back, and it's we're getting the program on. Whatever the program means, you know, back on track as to, you know, people coming in and having drinks and, you know, coming regularly. It's a regular spot for lots of locals.
Yeah,
like
right.
People live across the street and they come in every day.
And that's an interesting point about that spot, right? Second oldest restaurant in New Orleans and located on Decatur. You think tourist trap kind of place, but it's far from that.
It's not close to that. We have a lot of people coming in that are not from here, and they're walking by and they see the sign that says bar, Two Jacks, whatever. they can pronounce bar, but they can't pronounce two jacks. So they come in to try to figure out what the deal is. And, you know, they have a couple of drinks, have a good time, and they come back. And that's what it's all about. You want people to feel welcome, make people feel at home so that they can come back or whenever they back in the audience or go home and go like, you know what? I had a really, really good time in this place. That's what I want to do, as opposed to be just a place where, like a tourist trap. Because it's really easy to fall into that.
Very, very easy to fall into that. And that's a great point. Let's talk about this, you guys, for a second, because I know, Chris, that's something that here at Arno's and at French 75, one of the things that's traditionally important in New Orleans, hospitality is every bit an important component to the experience as much as the quality of the food, the quality of the cocktail. It's the service and the hospitality, and I know that's something that's important to you, too.
Yeah, it's... my restaurant is almost that old. We're going to be 100 next year, so we could have fallen into like the typical like the relic tourist trap, you know, this yada yada, like some of the other older places. And every city has their own. But I just knew that this room was too pretty to let it rest on its laurels, which is what we could have done. You know what I mean?
And but, a lot of them do, as you said.
But it's important when you actually care, and you're making the same drinks, whether it's a beautiful old room. The back bar here is 130. You know, the back bar at Two Jacks is the oldest in the whole city.
Right.
You know, it was like 100 when it sailed over here. I don't know as much of history as Paul does, but I went on one of the tours and found that out, and that's pretty awesome. So, you know, it's special that we can make the exact same drinks as like the other, you know, really cool hip bars, and we love those. Those guys are our best friends too. But you know, it's just important to keep something like this relevant.
Well, let me ask.
And it's like. You know what he said is like you want people to come into your bar and make them feel welcome,
right? Yeah,
you know. And when I brought in a friend of mine, hold on a minute, let me rephrase that. I brought in some woman that I met, you know, which is not a friend of mine. I met her at a bar,
an acquaintance.
And
I'm like, let's just go with acquaintance.
And I said, hey, do you want to go have a drink with me? And she goes, yeah, sure. So we came in here, and she was very impressed with the service and the people behind the bar and the way they treated people that they have never seen ever. Right. And that is a really huge thing, because being treated well because you're a local, that goes basically without saying.
Right.
But if you go into a bar where they don't know you and you get treated like you're a local, that's a huge, huge deal.
It's a great point. And let me ask you guys this, your thoughts on this, because one of the things that I know in having conversations with different restaurateurs around town and things, especially the younger generation of restaurateur that's rooted in New Orleans, you know, from here or been here for a long time, many folks have an understanding that the tradition of hospitality that we're talking about here is important. So they try and embrace it in their establishments. But then I think, and this is going to be kind of loaded or a generalization, I think we also see a lot of people who have come and opened establishments in town, we're not going to name names, that maybe don't have that fundamental understanding of what we're talking about here, how integral that is, and don't necessarily embrace it and maybe get away from it. Do you think that's fair?
Yes. Well, the way I think about it is that the most important aspect in the bar is not the person behind the bar.
Okay.
It's the way he or she treats the people that walk into the bar. Now, if you're known, famous, whatever word you want to use, I mean, everybody knows who Chris is.
Right.
All right? I mean, James Beard Award, whatever. When you walk into this bar, he's inviting.
Right.
And inviting does not mean the same thing to everybody. Like, inviting does not mean that you jump up and down for joy when you walk in the door with a fake smile on your face. Okay?
Yeah.
You invite him. You say, welcome, may I make you a drink?
Creating an environment, correct?
Exactly. And that's a really big thing. And a lot of people in the generation behind me, I don't know. How old are you?
Yeah, I'm not allowed to.
You're not allowed to say that.
Yeah. Not yet. There's too many people asking. Now it's making me all kind of worried.
But behind us, it's like they don't see that because they think they're the most important thing in the bar, and that's not true.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
But to your question and to follow what Paul said, you're right. And not to name any names, but what I think is really kind of cool is one of the newer establishments in the last 5 years actually noticed that there was something missing in their service, and they specifically told me that what they do is have their newer bartenders and servers in their place come here and just watch how all of us treat the guests when they come in here. So yeah, it is true. But I mean, I also have noticed that it's one of our friends, one of our mutual friends, you know, a really, really good friend, noticed that there was something missing in their environment. So they actually had their employees come here.
And to check it out.
Actually, yeah. So
yeah, but isn't that one of the things that you do as well? Is like, when you have a new employee, you tell them, okay, go there and there and there and there and there and see how people do things. I mean,
you guys do me one favor.
Chris has been doing it forever.
Can we hold a thought here? Because I want to come back to this topic. We got to take a little break. All right, come on back, you guys.
With the bucket in my hand, I'm just looking for a woman that ain't got no man. My bucket's got a hole in it. Yeah, my bucket's got a hole.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Yep, we're here at French 75, and we are chatting with Chris Hanna and Paul Gustings. And guys, before we went to the break, we were talking about hospitality, the importance of hospitality, and training your staff on it. And Chris and Paul, either one of you, just mentioned the idea. I like this. Well, let me throw this at you, Chris. You said every time when somebody starts here, they have to go see Paul over wherever he is now at Two Jags to go get a Sazerac and introduce themselves. And tell people why you do that.
Well, we have specific ways of where we make drinks, and the Sazerac is, our Sazerac is unique to the French 75 bar. And when we discuss about the ways and whether or not it's correctly made, I talk about how it's unique to the 75 bar. It has been longer than, and I've been here, which is obviously longer than them. And then I also say there's another very unique Sazerac in the city, and it belongs to Paul Gustings. And so as a homework assignment to anybody who starts here, they have to go over and introduce themselves to Paul, have a Sazerac, and then just, you know, start beginning to understand that we're in a community here,
right,
in New Orleans. And so then they'll obviously eventually get to all the rest of the bartenders in our group, but peers first, and special Sazerac, and always a special experience, which is sitting on the other side of the bar is Paul Gustings. So
right. Great. Yeah. You said something to me, Chris, that, when we were chatting the other day, a few weeks ago, we were at the fundraiser there at Trejo. And part of what you also require, you prefer when you hire people to work behind the bar, almost without exception, they have had to have worked the floor here first as a server. And you find that very important.
Yeah. The bar is really small. And, there's only one well behind the bar. It's an old bar. You know, it's not designed like bars now where there's always at least two wells to three. So there's like one station, and so pretty much I'm going to be at the station. So, you know, the new hirees here, the new bartenders have to be able to work the floor. It's also more like getting like personal, you know, experience with like guests, you know, serving whole tables. You know what I mean?
Right.
Carrying a tray. Like a lot of bartenders now, they're just, I mean, and that's fine. A lot of bartenders don't have to carry trays, but here, I mean, I carry a tray every day.
Mm-hmm.
So if I am, I mean, obviously you are, you know what I mean? If you're just, you know, right. just starting out. So it's like, that's what makes like a person who's actually going to work out here kind of unique, is being able to leave the bar, go to a table, you know, and not have that be beneath them. So I'm not calling anybody who works in here a cocktail server. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We take care of this room. You know what I mean? It's like mm-hmm. we're all
together.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh.
You know? Well, and Paul, what are some of your thoughts on that? About how do you go about teaching people hospitality? Well, let me ask you this, maybe frame it this way too. This is something that Chris and I were talking about before as well. I can teach you, I mean, not me personally, but one can be taught how to make a drink. It's harder to teach people nothing. The people skills and the hospitality, right?
Teaching people how to make a drink means absolutely nothing, because I can teach anybody how to make a drink. You write it down and they follow the instructions, and then you know, eventually you hope they can do it without the written instructions or whatever. But it goes back to what Chris just said, is you have to take care of the room. You have to make people feel at home. And that is a really important thing, and a lot of people don't get that. Mm-hmm. That you have to do that.
How do you impress that upon somebody that's new, or maybe that has come from some other family? You beat them?
I beat them.
Okay, right on.
That'll work. No, and the thing is, you know, that's a very good question, because on occasion, it's a really hard thing to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
That you go, okay, I want you to do these very specific things, and they go, who? At my last job? Well, you're not at your last job.
Right.
Okay, so... Right. Yeah. You have to do a certain thing, you know, and it's like one of the things that Chris said is like carrying a tray. I can't carry a tray to save my life because I have nerve damage in both my hands. And in order for me to carry a tray, I will drop. I'm going to drop it. Okay. I know I'm going to drop it. So I don't carry trays. But that goes a really long way on impressing people how welcome they are. It's like when you walk up to the table, and as opposed to having like two drinks in your hands, they're on a tray. Mm-hmm. People go like, oh, wow, look at this. Mm-hmm. It's a very great, good thing. It's a very small thing. But yes, all the people that work for me carry trays.
So it's, you know? Right.
I don't, because... I'll drop.
You have a doctor's note.
Yeah, exactly. One-on-one. My psychiatrist says I'm fine.
So it's an attention to detail, guys, that we're talking about here, that people, I may not sense it as a guest, meaning specifically checking the boxes.
Yes,
but it's
exactly.
That whole experience that's happening around me.
It's the same thing with body language and how behind the bar and how you dress and how you do things. I mean, you come in here and they look professional.
Right.
And then they act professional. It's the, you know, the white with the tuxedo and the bow tie and everything. And that is a really important part. You know, don't put your hands in your pockets. There's a whole bunch of other things that you don't do that people don't realize makes a really big impression on the people in your bar. Even the people in your bar don't realize it's a big impression, but it is.
It is, yeah.
It's a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. You were asking about how do you instill it upon the new employees, and you just explain like the entire situation, you know, of like the entire, you know, way that you're going to treat a table, serve a table, figure out where they are in their stay, if they're visiting, if they're just coming here before dinner, after dinner, and you know, the whole tray thing, and like, you know, getting over that and just realizing that everything is all about the guest's experience, and how you instill it in them is just say, I need them to come back, otherwise I can't pay a mortgage.
Right.
Okay, so and that means you can't pay rent. So that's, you know, everything is about their experience. Because then they're going to leave, they'll tell their friends, and their friends come back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even when you write down a list of bars and bartenders to go see, it helps their experience, and they just feel good about it. So no matter where they live, whether they're here or somewhere else, they're going to tell somebody, or they're going to come back, and that's how you pay Entergy. You know what
I
mean?
But I also think that writing down other places to go to is part of your job.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, I tell people all the time to go to other places. All the time, because I think I should.
Yeah.
If they go, hey, where should I go? I'm like, I don't know. that is not a good thing.
Right.
You know, it's like it's something that you need to do because it adds to their experience of the city of New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is a really important thing because it's not just about the French 75. It's not just about Two Jacks. It's not about whatever other place you want to put in there. It's these people come to New Orleans to have a really overall experience.
Right.
And if they walk into a place and the people in the bar or restaurant tell them other places, it adds to like, oh, look, they made this effort to tell me where to go and what to do.
Yeah.
And that's a really big thing.
Yeah,
it's
like
really
huge.
Big thing.
Yeah, they like that
huge.
We're all a good community down here. There's nobody that gripes about anybody else and that we all like are in it for each other. And also like humility goes a long way. So
absolutely. Yeah. That's you know, and tell me this, guys, I think is these are really good points. We got about a minute or so before we need to take another break, but I think how so much information is transmitted in this city is actually like we're doing here shoulder to shoulder at a bar.
Absolutely.
And so those recommendations, they mean a lot because of the medium in which this information is transmitted, whether it's coming from the other side of the bar from you all or me sitting on this side of the bar with a visitor and telling them what I like and where I go. Or
well, I mean, this is what I feel about this. If you ask 10 people about which place you want to go to, you get 15 different opinions.
Right.
Which...
Exactly.
There's places that I go to that nobody else would go to. Are places I would never think about going that other places think, oh wow, this is great.
Yeah,
but that's a good thing.
And you can figure out kind of like whether they'd want to go somewhere.
Absolutely,
like, you know, it's not too hard.
We're talking about like reading the room, the type of place that they want to go to, and where they might fit. Well, you guys, let's do this. So let me take a quick little break here. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about. Well, we were going to talk about fall drinks. We'll get there. And we're sitting here at Fred 75 with Chris Hanna and Paul. Stings,
things
come
get,
on back.
We get to talk about that before fall is over.
Yeah, there we go. We'll get there. Come on back.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In 2008, the Louisiana legislature made the Sazerac cocktail the official cocktail of New Orleans, affirming what New Orleanians had known for over 150 years. You just can't beat a good Sazerac. The Sazerac cocktail is the quintessential New Orleans drink, perfect for celebrating the arrival of fall festivals, football season, or just being proud to be a New Orleanian. For the official recipe, visit www.sazerac.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay. An ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petite Sirah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir. From the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers!
The French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m., on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickey Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickey Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickey Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickey Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. It's 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yes, we are here at the French 75 Bar chatting with Chris Hanna and Paul Gustings, and we were just talking here during the break about cigars. You're a big cigar guy, Chris, and Paul is not. So whenever Paul gets a cigar, he gives it to you, I guess.
It's a nice benefit.
Yes, I mean, people give me stuff, I'm like, I don't know what to do with this, and it's cigars, because I know Chris smokes cigars.
Right.
And he really enjoys it, so that's what I do with him.
There you go.
Yeah.
How long have you guys known each other? You guys known each other since you came to town, Chris, or
almost?
I have no idea.
Definitely, it's coming up on a decade.
Yeah, at least,
because there's that Christmas picture of us in 2010.
Okay,
with Jeffrey Wilson.
I forgot about that. Yeah. That was a great picture.
It is awesome.
Yeah. I saw that the other day.
Two Jacks, the first time.
When did you move here, Chris?
I moved here in 2004, so I've been here a little over 13 years.
Okay. And where did you start working here right away, or where were you initially?
Yeah, this is the first job I got. I was in here in the Richelieu Bar as well.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
All
right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I forgot the Richelieu Bar. That was the bar like 30 years ago that everybody went to.
That was the hangout. Okay. Yeah. Now, Paul, you've been here for, what, about 25 years, 30 years?
Is 19-something.
Okay. 19-something. Right on.
No, I can never remember whether it was 79, 80, 81, 82. I'd have no clue.
Somewhere in that range.
It was somewhere in that range that I came to New Orleans and never left.
Gotcha. So. Were you at the Napoleon House right away? Was that
No, I worked at some few less savory bars. I worked in a bunch of biker bars, music clubs, and then in '86 I started working at the Napoleon House.
Okay.
So then after that I worked at Two Jacks while at the Napoleon House, and I worked for the Brennans and a few other people.
Now, when you went to Napoleon House and say Two Jacks and stuff like that, was that when you started to make more classic cocktails and learn the profession at a higher level, or was
you know the thing is before? It's like when people ask me that and they go, so blah blah blah, about like what kind of spoon did you use when you started tending the bar? An iced tea spoon, because that's what we had.
Right.
Okay, the very first classic drink that I made, and I had no idea what this was. I was working at the Napoleon House, and I found a bottle of, I can't think of the name, Creme de Yvette, the other one.
Not Violet?
No, the other one.
Creme Violet.
It was a Bulls bottle.
Like Creme de Cassis or something like that?
No, but it was like a Creme de Yvette, and it was a Bulls bottle behind a post at the Napoleon House that had...
Parfait d'Amour?
Parfait d'Amour.
Yeah. Okay.
That had writing in Dutch on it. When I found that in 1986, that had to be at least 35 or 40 years old.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because they don't do that anymore. I'm like, what is this? So I made a Blue Moon.
Okay.
Which is lemon juice, gin, and that.
That.
Right? And I'm like, I had no idea what that was called. It's like, oh, let me do some stuff with this, you know? And I'm like, oh, that's not bad.
Stirred it with a teaspoon.
Yeah, basically. <you know? laughs> But no, I don't know when I started on classic drinks. I have no clue.
But it kind of makes sense, right, in the establishments that you're in, cater to that or don't cater to that, right?
And, yeah, you know, and also the thing is, what you have to realize, in the city of New Orleans, all the drinks, then we're out of style everywhere else in the country. Never went out of style in New Orleans.
You know, that's sort of why I'm asking that question.
And that is, yeah, I mean, yeah. You know.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, I bartended for 6 years before moving here and never heard of any of them.
Is this in Baltimore, Chris? Or
Baltimore, yeah. And in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. Then they...
And I mean, I was working at nice places, you know, really. Yeah. I mean, actually, at the James Beard Awards, I was there with my chef from over 20 years ago.
Okay.
And I told her, I was like, you're not going to remember me, but I bartended with you for the Charleston 20 years ago in Baltimore. But anyway, back to the question. I mean, really, really nice restaurants. You know, so you were happy to make martinis, old fashions. You would do Gibson's, Rusty Nail, and then that was it. I come down here. And I mean, I didn't get hired at Brennan. I mean, at the Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, because when I went in to fill out the application, they had on the application was write down these ingredients, and I didn't know what was in a milk punch.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I didn't know what was in a Sazerac. Yeah. I didn't know what was in a Pimm's cup. Yeah, and I'm just that. Like, oh man. I mean, I'm 6 years is a decent amount of time to be bartending in good restaurants.
Sure.
Yes.
And so. I didn't get the job there. Arno's hired me and trained me here in the Richelieu. And
got it.
Yeah.
You know, I actually asked this question a lot. We're essentially talking about this. And I think, Paul, when you were on with me a few months ago, we talked about this. It's, to your point, it's somewhat kind of funny when we have this conversation about the craft cocktail movement and so on and so forth, going back 15, 16, 17 years, call it 2000-ish, right? In a city that is this the original craft cocktail city? It never went away, as you said.
No, it never did.
And so where I'm going with this then is it's walking that line of honoring the original, the tradition, maintaining the tradition, and then still imbuing it with some amount of creativity. It sits on a very different framework here, I guess, is what I'm saying, than anywhere else, or nearly anywhere
else. Yeah, it is. It's very different from any other city that I've ever been, because you go to other places and they reinvent the wheel, and you know Fred Flintstone had a much rounder wheel than they have.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, because they do weird stuff that you go, why would you do that? Why do you think this would work together? You know, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But right, it's kind of like, don't put stuff together just to put stuff together.
One of the statements you guys that gives me the greatest amount of trepidation on any cocktail menu when I walk into the place is, here's our riff on
absolutely.
And it does, like you said, doesn't absolutely necessarily mean a bad thing. It could turn out just fine, but you can't riff on what you don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, it's the same thing. When I come in here, I walk in the door and they say, what would you like to drink? And I'm like, make me something.
Right. Yeah.
And if you walk into a place and they can do that, then they're good. Okay? Doesn't necessarily mean you always like. I mean, I've never had a drink and I didn't like. No, I have not. Every time you make me, but you also know me, so you know what I like.
Yeah, that's true.
But if you walk into a bar and they make you a drink and it's like, okay, I can deal with this, it's good, mm-hmm. That means it's not a bad bar. It's a good bar. They actually know what they're doing.
Know what they're doing. Yeah.
You know, it's like, but when people walk into my place and they go, so what's your specialty? I always tell them it's Bud Light.
Right. We do it well. We do it as consistently as possible.
It's very consistent. Exactly. You know? And then, you know, and another thing is, which I think is kind of an insulting question, is like, so what's your specialty one drink that you make well?
What
do you really
do well?
Yeah. Really? Like, all the other drinks that we make are, like, secondhand, not really that good.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, oh, man, you know? And but I get that all the time.
I just have to, like, I spend so many times, and it's been so long now, I just kind of look through them, and then first thing I always say is, like, what do you normally drink? And then they don't see how annoyed I really am. You know what I mean? It's just like, you know, let's just get over that part. And then if you like to drink, then we can start the real conversation.
Yes.
And this
actually very true.
This friendship. You know what I mean?
Okay.
But it's the first 3 seconds. You're just kind of like not even acknowledging what they really just said. With your facial expression. But you're just like, what do you normally drink? Okay. And then you're gonna make them this.
Yeah. What do you like best? These questions are always so loaded that it doesn't.
It is like,
you've got to give me more. Right.
And I like it now that a lot more people are asking, do you have a drink menu? Because if you show them a drink menu, then they have some idea of what you are able to do and capable of doing well,
mm-hmm.
that they go, oh, I can venture out and talk to you about whatever. But if
here's an interesting rum drink. I like rum.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. So what is it that you can make? And it's like what Chris had just said, you know. I always ask people, what is it that you like and what is it that you don't like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's right. A really good beginning for this relationship on how to make you a drink that you're going to like.
Right. Give me some parameters. Give me something to work with.
You know.
Let's do this, you guys. Let's take another break here, and we're going to be back. We're going to chat with Chris and Paul. And eventually, to your point, Paul, we'll get to fall drinks, maybe by next fall. We'll do that. And but interesting conversation here, friends. We're chatting with Chris Hanna and Paul Gustings, sitting here at French 75, of course, part of the famous Arnaud's Restaurant, Bienville, in the French Quarter. Come on back.
Look at my king, all dressed in red. I go one day. I bet you $5 he'll kill you dead. Chugga Mofina, nay. Talking about henna,
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 henna.
I go one day. Chugga Mofina, anane. Chugga Mofina, nay.
Hey, ladies. Are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm going to need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. When I get back to New Orleans, I've got my...
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Yep, we are sitting at French 75, and we're chatting with Chris Hanna, his place. Again, thanks, Chris, for hosting us here today.
Oh, this is a lot of fun.
Yeah,
very
thank
happy.
You, man. Awesome. And Paul Gustings, who... took time out from his day off and his normal stint at Aaron Rose. Well, you truncated your stay at Aaron Rose, I understand. You still went.
Well, you said I had 2 hours, but I usually get there at 1.
Oh,
so I
had
to do 2 hours of drinking between 1 and 2 to get here. So I decided to go at 11.
Perfect. I figured you would calibrate in some fashion or another. So
no, I'm good.
Glad that worked out well.
Yeah, I have a standard... date with some people that I know at Aaron Rose every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. We get together, we talk about stuff.
Sure.
You know, like what we're doing right here is like this and that, but the business, not business, the weather, you know, me wanting to go on a vacation to Chalmette, you know, and all those things.
all those really important things, my big plans for the coming weeks.
The big plans for the coming weeks, yeah. Or the next couple of hours about the vacation, you know.
Right. Well, one of the things you guys that we've been promising to talk about for the past three segments is drinks.
Right.
Let's touch on this because I was very curious, Chris. You guys,
yeah, but in order to start about drinks, we need like some people to know what they're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right.
I think we're good because you guys know how to make them and I know how to drink them.
Okay, so good. We're good.
I think we're good that way. But you guys, we were talking a little bit, it just caught my attention. Talk about a little bit of the difference between your two Sazeracs or approaches to Sazeracs, if you don't mind. We don't have to go too far down the road, but.
Yeah, I'll go first. Our Sazerac is pretty much the least diluted Sazerac because it's not prepared correctly at all. But it's, you know, it's a decent, it's a really, really, un, it's interestingly balanced Sazerac. We have a freezer here. We pull the water glass out of the freezer. I'll roll some herb saint in. Make sure there's a little bit of a puddle. Add Peychaud bitters. We do 6 to 7 dashes. And then we add a little bit of simple syrup. And the rye whiskey we have in the fridge already chilled.
Okay.
So it's old overhold. It's 80 proof, which is, you know, it's, you know, decent enough to just do a shot by, you know. So we just pour 2 ounces of that, add it to the glass, give it a stir with the spoon with no ice in it at all, lemon peeled, and it's served.
Okay. Gotcha.
So, yeah.
So there's one thing I disagree with him.
Okay.
And that is that it's not made the correct way.
That's fair. And please elaborate. I think it is. Yeah.
Because if you have, I've had the Sazerac here, and I don't drink a whole lot of Sazeracs in a lot of places, and I think it's good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the way I make it, but that doesn't mean anything. If you have a high volume bar, you need to do things to expedite your business. That's the way it is.
I know you like to batch and stuff
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. Yep. So this Sazerac for here is really, really good. Like mm-hmm. I said, I've had it. I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It saves us also.
Exactly. It saves you a whole lot of time.
After we become so much busier
exactly.
in the last decade, I'm like, back of my mind, I'm like, I'm so glad we've never changed this Sazerac.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And it works just fine. No, my thing is, I use Herb Saint, I use Peychaud bitters, Sazerac whiskey. What else is in there? Oh, lemon twist. Forgot about that one.
Yeah, a little sugar.
It's a simple. Little sugar, yes. Yeah. I use 11 dashes of Peychaud bitters, and I twist the lemon twist on the glass and put the oils in it, and then discard the lemon twist.
Oh, that's right.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Which is basically, it's the same drink, except I don't have a lemon twist in it, and I use twice as many bitters.
Do you guys do the? Do you guys do an Herb Saint rinse?
No. I toss the glass up in the air. Yeah, that is kind of like
part of the show.
Yeah, that you don't. It's the spray bottle thingy is like that's stupid.
Yeah, right. it's kind of new school. I'll have to confirm with Hattie about whether or not he actually does 11 or 14 dashes of Peychaud, though. But it's interesting. You should definitely watch him next time.
We'll go now. He's over at the Sazerac Bar at the Roosevelt Hotel. We'll do a little field trip. Fact finding.
You know, the thing
three different styles of Sazeracs. Very
true. With the spray bottle, is that if you take the glass and you spray it in there, it doesn't coat the inside of the glass.
Right.
It coats part of the glass that you sprayed it in.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
you still have to do other things, which they don't do.
Right.
You know, and it's, and it is like I said, you know, it's like you need to expedite whatever it is that you do for your customers, your guests, or whatever you want to call them. And the way you do it here works just fine.
Yeah, we don't need
it's
to
a
be.
Great, it's a great drink.
Yep.
I've had it. I've actually had more Sazeracs here than I've had on my own.
Okay, right. There you go. I mean, this is an important point, probably a topic for a future show, is that, you know, the idea is that we're not talking about coming into a bar and ordering something where I watch you carve a dolphin out of a piece of pineapple for 20 right. minutes, right? I mean, I'd like to have a drink within a few minutes. Is that reasonable?
Dolphin?
I was just coming up with something. I was coming up with advanced garnish here, Paul, as well as I possibly could.
You know that I am probably the person who puts no garnishes in 95% of my drinks.
So you have not been going to the United States Bartenders Guild chapter meetings for advanced garnish, is what you're saying?
No. Yeah, I have not. You know, I would like to be the speaker at one of those things. Because if garnishes...
I'd like to go watch that happen, yeah.
If garnishes...
Yeah, I hope Beach Bum's there for that one.
You know, if garnishes... Yeah, exactly. You know, if garnishes serve a purpose, I'm all for it. But if they're superfluous in just making stuff look pretty... I think it's a waste everything.
I wish. I'm not there yet. I think I have another decade before I can go. Before I can have this opinion. So what we have to do is we have to like do all kinds of more prep earlier. So when it does come to the garnish, it isn't taking up the time at all.
It's ready to go.
Yeah, we have the dehydrator and everything.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, yeah. I don't do any of that.
You know, speaking of this decade, I wanted to go back to where you were when you were at Napoleon House. I was in Memphis at this old used bookstore. Really quickly, we'll go back to the drinks. And I'm looking at this old Wine Spectator's guide to New Orleans. And then I'm looking, and I get to this picture. There's only one bartender in the section, and I'm like, "That's Paul Gustings at Napoleon House in '90," and I'm just like, "Oh, it's awesome!" You know, he had a brown mustache back then, though.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I took this gray doesn't come natural. I dye it every day.
I took a picture and I sent it. I was like, dude, this is awesome, man. I'm in like this used bookstore, 1990, Wine's Spectator Guide to New Orleans, and you're in. This is super cool.
That's a collector's item, Chris.
I know.
Yeah, it is. Well, you guys,
thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
We didn't really talk about fall drinks, so here's what we're going to do, because we got about a minute and a half left before we got to end the show, actually. Why don't we plan on doing this, like, maybe in, we'll do winter drinks. How's that in a few weeks?
We can do that.
We'll do that, and we'll actually talk about the drinks, so we got some of this other stuff out of the way. But in the minute and a half or so we have left, Paul, why don't you tell people where they can find you at Two Jags, you know,
I work at Two Jags after 3 o'clock. And I'm off Tuesday and Friday.
Okay, great. And Two Jags is on Decatur. What's the address?
823 Decatur Street, and it's open every day from usually our 10 o'clock in the morning until about 9 or 10 o'clock at night.
Okay, great. And Chris, where can people find you or we are?
It's 813 Bienville, so it's Bienville between Bourbon and Dauphine. And we open a little bit after 5, and I'm here Tuesday through Saturday.
Perfect.
Off Sunday, Monday.
Awesome. And it's part of Arno's. I want to make sure that we mention that. And both places at Two Jags and Arno's, because we've been talking obviously a lot about the bar program, but great places to go eat too, right?
Oh, excellent.
Absolutely.
Yeah, excellent.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, kitchen opens at 6. We have a brunch on Sundays, so...
Okay, and Two Jags is open for lunch and dinner.
Right? We're open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week.
Yeah, great. So. Two great historical spots, friends, in New Orleans that you need to go check out. And Chris, thanks again for hosting us here at French 75 today.
This was a lot of fun.
Paul, thanks, buddy. I appreciate you.
I appreciate you. Thank you very much.
On your day off. Friends,
Chris, thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Right on, brother. Good to see
you. Thanks for the beer, you guys. Appreciate it. Yeah. Friends, thanks for tuning in here to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you. We're going to be back with another show next week. We'll figure that out as we go, as we always do. Really appreciate you all tuning in. Have a great weekend. Kind to each other. Use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all.
Wait, I don't drive.
Thank God. Cheers, y'all.